You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel, and I am sitting in for Maggie on this Friday afternoon. We are talking all about democracy once again. We're talking about the rule of law. We're talking about justice in America. Appreciate very much the involvement in our discussion of my friend, my colleague, his name, John Vaudrey, former U.S. attorney. Under the Obama administration, working for Eric Holder, as did I here in the state of Wisconsin. John Vaudrey, now affiliated with this group that works on democracy issues, in particular, this notion that somehow that elections in the past have been stolen, compromised in some way, the group CORE, Keep Our Republic, which John represents and does work on behalf of. Providing information and practical insight into why that simply isn't true and encouraging people to have confidence in the elections in our nation, including right here in the state of Wisconsin. John, thanks again for joining me here on the Maggie Dawn Show. I am joined here in the studios of Civic Media here in Racine Park by my wonderful producer. His name is Jacob. And together we are taking your questions, not only about our discussion with John, but of course about Supreme Court cases as well. That phone number here is 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. And we do have a caller on the line, and we're going to go to that right now. We appreciate very much Cam calling in from Appleton. Cam, thank you for joining us in the afternoon. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. Thanks for being a part of our discussion.
Thank you for taking my call. Happy Friday, guys.
Happy Friday to you, too.
Listening to that last hour was actually very frustrating because I think that for the most part, those are really good guidelines to follow for like common sense and applying it to how realistically that happen? It's kind of like the Bigfoot or UFOs, right? Like where you say in an age where everyone has a cell phone that can zoom 100 times, how is there not a clear photo of Bigfoot or aliens? It's kind of like that.
Right.
But when
the notion is that what John and I were talking about was just, and actually when we were in court on a routine basis, we would sometimes argue this to courts and to juries. You know, if you've got this many people involved in an enterprise this extensive, in this case it's voting at a very local level, the notion that there could be widespread fraud has got to be discarded. Why? Because in the end, it would require a conspiracy, quite literally, whether it's tens of people, hundreds of people, thousands of people, everybody getting together to say something, do something, and report on something that would require all of these folks, every single one of them, to engage in a conspiracy, in this case of silence, as you're sort of indicating. It's just too much to believe. But Cam, go ahead with your comment or your question. Why was this frustrating to you? Cam? All right, Cam apparently no longer with us. And we've got again, we'll take phone calls from anyone here, 855-752-4842. Cam apparently back on the line. Let's finish up our conversation with Cam, and then we're going to move on to Supreme Court cases as well. Cam, we dropped you for just a moment or so, but wanted to make certain we've got an opportunity for you to join in our conversation this afternoon, your thoughts or comments upon elections.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. So Rockland County, New York has a case open right now that has just entered discovery where they're looking to get some of the source code for the voting machines and the Starlink stuff because the Starlink satellite at modems, because the machines, it really needs to stop being parroted that they're not connected to the internet, because in some ways they are. Every single voting machine in the U.S. has a wireless modem in it for performing updates, and they can be connected to the internet. The fact that they have these at all, I'm telling you as an IT expert, it makes them not safe, period. And the machines themselves do not have tamper-proof cabling inside of them.
Okay,
so
and Cam,
that court case is proceeding.
Good. All right. So we've got a court case out there, and so the question discovery is all about determining, as John Vaudry and I are saying, let's get the evidence, right? Your point is simply, if it is out there, let's see what can be produced. That's what discovery is all about. No findings yet.
It's the one piece.
And right, and it's just that aspect to it. I will tell you, the voting machines that I work with routinely do not have those kinds of connections. I see it all the time. It was done by the court clerk. But Kim, appreciate your participation in our program this afternoon, and we'll continue to focus on the integrity of elections in America. Appreciate your commitment to all of that. We also have Len calling in from Madison. Len, appreciate you too being a part of our discussion this afternoon on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Hi, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. Hey, I got this Uncle Terry that's a big MAGA guy. He's also a poll worker, and I have a little bit of trouble arguing with him when it comes to his having that kind of inside expertise. And he was throwing some of the same stuff that I think it was Kim just said. Yes. About the security of the systems. But a couple of the things he brought up that I had no response to, and I figured maybe you could set me straight on it. He received a notification from his employment several years ago that somebody had gotten ballots in his name and had voted in a local election that he wasn't interested in voting in and had no interest in, and didn't find out till a couple of years later when he got this notification from his union, from their lists or whatever, about elections he had participated in, and somebody on two occasions had stolen his vote and he didn't have anything to do about it. And talking about my grandfather in another situation, he was detailing some information about how my grandfather hadn't voted in any elections in many, many, many years, but when he had gone online on the My Vote or whatever to check, well, sure enough, he had obtained an absentee ballot, which he didn't really obtain, supposedly, and that had been returned, and now it's sometime after the fact. And I was telling him, hey, if that's the case, you could just get that vote back and it wouldn't count.
Right.
And you probably need some ID to get that thing in the first place. You can't just go online and order it, you know, where it would show up in the mail at the nursing home.
Right.
And somebody could take it out of the mail. So you can't just order up an absentee ballot over the internet.
Right. In someone else's name with their address, again, here in the state of Wisconsin, right?
No. In the name, like somebody from the nursing home could go and say, hey, oh, here's a guy that doesn't vote. I'll just go online.
No, that's right.
That shows up in the mail. I take it out and return it, and nobody will know the better.
Right. Yeah. All kinds of things. Again, I have many, many questions about your grandfather and your uncle, of course, about those circumstances. And again, as we're talking, it depends. Again, you need to follow up and ask them specific questions about, again, are you registered to vote? All kinds of securities in place. Have you voted? Did you ask for an absentee ballot? If so, did you receive that? And I will tell you from my own personal experience, again, serving for many years now in a municipality here in Milwaukee in the area, all kinds of checks and balances, all kinds of notations inside the delivery and the mailing of ballots, the return of them, checking to determine, obviously, when people come in to vote, that they are indeed the person who is voting there. Registration is very tight. You fill out a form. You've got to certify all kinds of things related to your present residence here. And that's not to say that from time to time something irregular happens. But I would encourage you, Len, to ask your uncle or your grandfather to follow up on those things. If they've gotten some indication that somehow there is something that went awry, that's when you go to your court clerk and say, I'm looking at something. Plainly, if the representation is true, I didn't vote and I want to figure this out. I want to make certain that indeed your records are accurate, that whatever needs to be corrected is corrected. And you can be assured that the court clerk, certainly here in Wisconsin, and I believe in all the other states in this country, will also take that seriously. As I said in my own accounting about how this works, we look at every single ballot. And if there is something that's irregular about it, we track that down to make certain that there is no fraud. And indeed, if there are those circumstances, for example, where an absentee ballot gets in someone else's hands, that's the kind of thing that a court clerk needs to know about, because he or she is responsible for the integrity integrity of the overall system. So my recommendation to you, Len, is when you have that conversation with your relatives, ask them for more detail and ask them again to go back to the court clerk and ask for more clarity on what happened, when it happened. The upshot is that this does not happen with great frequency. And again, this notion that there is widespread fraud in such a way, as John Vodrey and others were affirming here, such widespread fraud that the entire election is skewed. And therefore, for example, the use of the machines somehow corrupts the entire system. It does not. And again, the courts of law have taken a look at this with respect to the 2020 election. We may get more of them now as this issue resurfaces. And they once again will do what? They'll go into court and take evidence. Sworn evidence will do all the discovery that Cam was talking about before. We'll find out what the truth is. And if indeed there is one or two instances out there where something happened that should not have happened, identify that and correct it. The upshot is highly, highly, highly unlikely that there will be any evidence of widespread fraud. Len, appreciate very much your contributions to our conversation this afternoon. As we continue to talk about the integrity of our voting systems, about the integrity of our systems generally in America related to the rule of law and the application and the administration of justice here on the Maggie Dawn Show. We are going to continue in this segment and future segments here in this afternoon of Friday, talking about the United States Supreme Court. Once again, hearkening back to our discussion in the first segments of the first hour to this major decision. Arguably, there are many cases decided, one of the, if not the most important decision with respect to process and procedure in America going forward. The case is Trump, President of the United States, versus CASA, C-A-S-A. Plaintiffs, who are individuals and organizations and states, filed three separate lawsuits to enjoin the implementation and the enforcement of the president's executive order. That was the order that he issued on the first day of his presidency, identifying circumstances in which a person born in the United States, not subject to the jurisdiction thereof, he's using there the language of the 14th Amendment, and thus not recognized as an American citizen. That was what the executive order basically said. The plaintiffs alleging, of course, that violates the clear language and the purpose of the 14th Amendment. Each of those cases, the district court agreed with them, and they entered also these universal injunctions, across-the-board injunctions, barring executive officials from applying the executive order to anyone across the nation, not just the plaintiffs. And that was the focus of what the Supreme Court was focusing on in its order announced today. In every single case, the Court of Appeals also denied the government's request to stay the imposition of this sweeping relief. The government argued then that the lower courts lacked the authority to impose this universal relief and therefore went to the Supreme Court. The applications did not raise, and thus the court did not address whether or not the president's interpretation was accurate or not, but did apply some rules and regulations and thoughts on this universal application. We'll talk more about that when the Maggie Dawn Show continues here on Civic Media.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie Dawn this afternoon, and doing that in the wake of the issuance by the Supreme Court of six more major decisions this past week. We'll be talking about many of those and more cases that it also decided in this term. This weekend, a 9 to 11 broadcast tomorrow, that's Saturday, on Amicus Law Review. Then doing another program Sunday from 2 to 4, also talking about the Supreme Court term just now concluded. Supreme Court continues to show up at their jobs there on Capitol Hill at the Supreme Court building throughout the summer. They will plainly continue to entertain these emergency applications, and those will continue to animate much of our discussion here on the Maggie Dawn Show and certainly on Amicus Law Review. But today we are thinking an awful lot about what the Supreme Court has ruled on in connection, arguably, with birthright citizenship, but not really. Not really in the end, issuing a major opinion, not without its dissenters. We're going to talk about those in just a moment or so. Basically finding that federal district court judges and appeals court judges do not have the authority to issue these worldwide, these national, these universal injunctions. They can only do it with respect to the particular plaintiffs in front of them. Important to note, once again, that the notion of injunctive relief, entering a temporary restraining order, entering an injunction, that is still much available to courts, and that happens all the time in our state and federal courts in America. What the Supreme Court has said that federal judges cannot do is they cannot make their injunctive orders applicable basically across the nation, which has been the case with respect to the issue having to do with the 14th Amendment and birthright citizenship. The court's decision, again, basically upending the ability of single federal judges to freeze those policies across the nation. And the reason why it's so significant is that it applies presumably not just to birthright citizenship issues, but also all sorts of other orders out there that including, for example, halting the firing of civil servants, the defunding of foreign aid. For example, the location of transgender women in federal prisons, in men's housing, those kinds of things, all kinds of things across the board, where district court judges have in recent months responded to the executive orders of this president that have been dramatic and, from the perspective of many, including the district court and appellate court judges, unconstitutional. They've extended the breadth, the scope, the impact of their orders beyond just the particular jurisdiction. For example, the Western District of Wisconsin, the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and said this will apply nationwide. That is what the Supreme Court has said you can no longer do. And that is the reason why. That is the reason why both media and indeed the President of the United States of America has praised this ruling. He has called it a giant ruling. He was talking at a news conference in the White House this afternoon. He said, our country should be very proud of the Supreme Court today. Again, significantly, the Supreme Court basically stayed its own order, said you've got basically 30 days in which to simmer on all of this, and suspended its ruling for that period of time. The order from the president does not take effect for another 30 days, a 6-3 decision, and also, again, making very clear that it does not resolve the issue of birthright citizenship itself. Now, the problem with that, of course, is exactly what was discussed during the course of oral arguments, which is now, presumably, because there will not be a universal injunction out there, you may have quite literally thousands, maybe tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of lawsuits, each one of them going into a federal court asking for a specific judgment of a federal district court judge saying, in my particular case, I am indeed a citizen of the United States of America by virtue of where I've been born, and that indeed I am subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And that may have to be accomplished on an individual, fact-by-fact, circumstance-by-circumstance case and situation. And that would pose a huge problem, and may pose a huge problem, to the administration of justice in America. And that leads to the other suggestion that is inside the majority opinion in this case, and that is class actions. Now, class actions themselves are not the answer to all of this, because indeed, you don't simply walk into court and file a document that proclaims that you're now litigating on behalf of a class of 10 people or 20 people or 20,000 people across the country. You can file that action and ask a federal district court judge to certify, basically to find the class is composed of people who are sufficiently similar in nature and who are suffering the same kind of injury. But it requires a huge amount of litigation, even with respect to creating the class of people inside a particular court. It may well be that that's what we've got left in terms of addressing this issue and pushing back on this notion that the 14th Amendment does not, in fact, mean what it says and says what it means. Indeed, there is reporting already that there are litigants out there running into courts filing not only those individual cases, but class actions as well, seeking basically to substitute a class action proceeding, much more cumbersome, much more lengthy in its duration, for what the Supreme Court today found unconstitutional and found inappropriate for specific district court judges to do, which is enter an order and make it applicable across the nation for all people. Class action is still very much out there, suggested by the Supreme Court, and probably now the way that this is going to be addressed, maybe with respect to other executive orders as well. When we come back, we'll hear from the dissenters in this major case. We're going to hear from the three of them and what they said about what the majority did here on the Maggie Dawn Show. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie today. This Friday, June 27th, a major day in the history of our nation as the Supreme Court doesn't end its term, but ends the time period, as it always does in late June, sometimes early July, for its issuance of these major decisions. It issued about 62, 63 opinions altogether, a 65-case docket altogether, and they're already beginning to animate and to fill and populate their docket for the next term, which begins on the first Monday of October. That's the 2025-2026 term. We've talked about some of those cases, but today, right now, we're talking about this major case that was issued by the Supreme Court just hours ago, Trump versus Casa, finding, as the Supreme Court says, that universal injunctions exceed the authority that Congress has given to federal courts to do. And so it's much broader than just the issue related to birthright citizenship, and indeed will almost certainly lead to a drastic reduction in the federal court's ability to check the White House on many of these kinds of executive orders that it has issued. Once again, as we indicated before the break, one option, of course, is a class action lawsuit. It's much more cumbersome in terms of putting it in place in any district court. You can also go into court in particular as to your own circumstances. And that's precisely what was argued during the course of the oral arguments on this case. You may indeed get a patchwork of understandings as one state does indeed acknowledge your citizenship based upon the place of your birth. Another state across the border may not do that, may require, again, going into court in all of those instances, not only to address your particular circumstance, but also those of others down the road. A lot to consume, a lot to consider down the road. This opinion, of course, authored by Amy Coney Barrett, she delivers the opinion of the court on behalf of a 6-3 divided court. We've got joining in this opinion, John Roberts, he's the Chief Justice, Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh. And we also have Clarence Thomas filing a concurring opinion. Gorsuch joins in that. Alito files a concurring opinion. Lots of them writing all sorts of things. We have three justices of the Supreme Court who take great exception to what the majority has done today. And indeed, the principal among those is Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She called the majority's decision a travesty for the rule of law, and indeed many others who are consuming, as we all are, digesting this opinion today, both inside and outside Washington, looking at the impact and viewing this as, quite candidly, a major blow to long-settled constitutional law, the ways in which we have done things in America. Many people saying that will create a dangerous patchwork, again, of rights across our nation in this particular area and arguably in other areas as well. Let's talk a little bit more about what some of the dissenters have said about this. Once again, we have Sonia Sotomayor, joined in a dissent by Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson. She said that the majority played right into the president's hand, these are her words, by cutting back the ability of judges on lower courts to issue injunctions blocking Trump's policies nationwide. Now, what does she mean by that? Well, she said that the government has not asked for complete stays of the injunctions because to get that relief, she said, it would have to prove Trump's order narrowing birthright citizenship for children born on U.S. soil who don't have at least one parent with permanent legal status is likely constitutional. That's a lot. That's a lot of wonky legal stuff. It's basically saying that because of the way in which the majority has decided this case, it may not inure in the long term to the benefit of a president who would like his particular position to be the one that is adopted by the courts. Again, the Supreme Court not adopting his position. A lot of this is still pending in the appeals courts, as the president and the attorney general and others have acknowledged today. The attorney general, by the way, promising that this case will come back in some way to the Supreme Court in this coming term. That's virtually impossible to understand how that would happen. But Sonia Sotomayor, in all of that connection, goes on to say this. So the government instead tries its hand at a different game, she says, pointing to the Trump administration's bid to tear down nationwide injunctions. Basically, you failed to get your what you wanted in the major issue here, instead looking at this other issue. She goes on to say this. The gamesmanship in this request is apparent, and the government makes no attempt to hide it. Yet, shamefully, this court plays along. That's Sonia Sotomayor talking about the majority position here. She says, with a stroke of a pen, the president has made a solemn mockery of our Constitution. Rather than stand firm, the court gives way. Because such complicity, she says, should know no place in our system, I dissent. It is significant, once again, that she notes that her dissent is not with respect. Indeed, she read her dissent from the bench the second time that she's done that this term, which also underscores, when justices do that, the severity, the sincerity, the seriousness of what they're meaning to say. She read her dissent from the bench just this morning. We also, of course, have a dissent from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, and she in many ways echoes what Sonia Sotomayor has also said about what happened today and the lack of content, lack of strength between the decision of the majority and even the concurrences to that. This is what Ketanji Brown Jackson has said. She said, it is important to recognize that the executive's bid to vanquish so-called universal injunctions is at bottom a request for this court's permission to engage in unlawful behavior. That's Ketanji Brown Jackson writing. She goes on to say this, when the government says, do not allow the lower courts to enjoin executive action universally as a remedy for unconstitutional conduct, what is actually being said is that the executive wants to continue doing something that a court has determined violates the Constitution. Please allow this. That is some solicitation. That's what Ketanji Brown Jackson, that's how she described what the Department of Justice, what the president has asked the Supreme Court to do, and what the Supreme Court has said. Ketanji Brown Jackson suggested the Constitution was designed to split the powers of a monarch between three governing branches to protect the American people from overreach. She said those core values are strangely absent from the majority ruling today. And she says, with deep disillusionment, I dissent. What she's talking about there are also the consequences of this. And recognize, in fairness, that there are people on all sides of the political aisle who oppose nationwide universal injunctions. Recognize that right now, the petitions in the federal district and appellate court petitions, those pending in the courts, the judges around the country, they are attacking, they're challenging the petitions of this particular president, this particular administration. It may well be that if there is a future president who, for example, as Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor say, if there is an executive order that says you can no longer own weapons in America, something that's plainly unconstitutional under the Second Amendment, if a future president, for example, were to say that by virtue of executive order, surrender all your guns, I'm directing you to do that, and a federal district court judge says, no, you can't do that because that's in violation of the Second Amendment, the only applicability that it would have would be for the particular plaintiff in the case that's pending in front of that judge. Maybe a class action pending in front of that judge, but could not have national applicability, even though that is an issue, plainly, that should be resolved and is resolved now under the Second Amendment.
That's the kind of thing that the justices in the dissent are calling to our attention, that this is not just applicable to a Donald Trump administration. It's applicable to future administrations as well. And had it been the law in the past, would have been applicable to other nationwide injunctions. We recall on the Maggie Dawn Show and on other broadcasts of civic media, for example, the nationwide injunction entered by Judge Kaczmarek in the Northern District of Texas many years ago, finding stunningly that the FDA had not properly vetted mifepristone as a proper and safeguarded medical drug for the purpose of reproductive rights and accomplishing medical abortions under a doctor's care. He said that he found that the FDA's review of mifepristone was inadequate, and he embraced some scant evidence to the contrary, basically evidence that was discredited. And what Judge Kaczmarek did at that time was entered a national injunction preventing the use, the applicability, the purchase, the sale of mifepristone. Now, fairly promptly, that was rescinded by an appeals court, but it underscores in the opposite direction the consequences of today's opinion. In that instance, too, you could not have the kind of thing that Judge Kaczmarek entered. Many of you may say that that is a good thing. Others may say that's a bad thing. The point of this is that regardless of what your political views are, regardless of what your partisan views are, that this notion that there can be no instances, none whatsoever, even issues related to basic constitutional rights, freedom of speech, of religion, of assembly, press, those kinds of things, Second Amendment rights, all kinds of things that James Madison and John Adams also endorsed, but James Madison wrote in our Constitution, that can and should have national applicability. That can no longer happen by virtue of a singular district judge finding that to be the case. And indeed, that was also a part of the argument. Indeed, during the course of that argument, Amy Coney Barrett had said that maybe, just maybe, we've got to craft a rule, something that she does not do today, craft a rule that says in circumstances where there are those plainly colossal national, nationwide issues that are of a constitutional dimension, maybe in those instances we can have district court judges, maybe appeals court judges, entering these kinds of things subject to appellate review. But maybe in many other cases it applied just locally, regionally, maybe to a district, maybe to the particular litigants before a judge or a series of judges. Maybe in those instances, those should not be applied nationally. That's difficult to do. That's difficult to craft and order a rule that is applicable to district court judges and how they handle their cases. But that's probably the role of a Supreme Court, to tell lower court judges how they're supposed to act. And that's one of the other problems, of course, out there these days with not a case here. This is not a case involving the shadow docket. This is not a case involving an emergency application, although it was fast-tracked by the Supreme Court. But in those cases, and about 19 of them, in which we are seeing a Supreme Court not give direction to lower courts to tell them what it means, to tell them what, for example, deportation means. Their failure, for example, earlier this week to give to Judge Brian Murphy clear direction on what he can and cannot do now with respect to some deportees who are in Africa. That, too, underscores the need for the Supreme Court to be specific and to give rules out there. That's what we lack today. That's what we do not have today. We've got a bright line rule instead. When we come back here in the Maggie Dawn Show, we'll talk more about the Supreme Court, mentioning some of the other cases decided by your United States Supreme Court in its major decisions of just earlier today here on the Maggie Dawn Show.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel. In this, the final segment of our broadcast this Friday afternoon, June 27th, another historic day in the life and the livelihood of our nation. The Supreme Court basically done for this term in issuing something in excess of 60 cases altogether, had oral arguments in almost all of those, and right now beginning to populate its next docket, going to be undertaking oral arguments and taking briefs in from the parties beginning, obviously, right now, but hearing oral arguments in October, November, December, January, February of this coming term.
But today we have six more major decisions from the Supreme Court, including this major decision from the majority, a 6-3 majority of the Supreme Court, saying that the days of nationwide universal injunctions are over. Great consequences, not only for the issue of birthright citizenship, as we discussed, as the authors of both the majority and the minority opinions have also discussed, but also for many other things related to the president's executive orders across the board. The capacity, of course, of federal district court judges to act, that's not compromised or restricted. They can still enter injunctive orders. The issue is just how broad can they be? They probably now have to apply just to the plaintiffs in front of them. Arguably to the jurisdictions, the districts in which they're sitting. But no doubt, a major process, a major civil procedure change in the way that government works and that courts work, accomplished by the United States Supreme Court earlier today. Supreme Court, again, issuing six cases, six opinions all together today. Let's talk about those briefly, knowing that we'll talk more about them over this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review, 9 to 11, tomorrow morning, Saturday, the 28th, and again, a second time on Sunday, at more 2 hours of new content, talking about somewhere between about 10 to 12 cases across the board. But we know that just this morning, Supreme Court rejected a challenge to a Texas law that sought to limit minors' access to pornography on the internet. The Supreme Court ruling that it does not violate the First Amendment to require people to verify their age through measures like what? Like the submission of a government-issued ID. That coming out of the Supreme Court just earlier today. The vote 6-3. The court's three liberal members in dissent will talk more about that case. That case this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. We've got another case involving LGBTQ storybooks. You know what this case is about as well. Public schools in Maryland, by virtue of a decision issued just this morning, have to allow parents with religious objections to withdraw their children from classes in which storybooks with LGBTQ themes are discussed. That's the ruling of the Supreme Court. Again, 6-3, three court members, you know who they are, dissenting. The case concerning a new curriculum adopted in 2022 by the Montgomery County Public Schools, that's Maryland's largest school system, for pre-kindergarten through the fifth grade in that school district, must allow parents with religious objections to withdraw their children from those classes. We'll talk more about that case as well this coming weekend. Interestingly, that in the published versions of the opinion, you've actually got color versions of some aspects, some excerpts from those particular storybooks, including Pride Puppy, Love Violet, Born Ready, and Uncle Bobby's Wedding. The Supreme Court justices have decided to post actual color pictures of what those books are all about in their decisions. They're in an appendix. You can go online and take a look at those right now. It's good to read the opinion, but if you want to get a sense of what this case is all about visually, they're there as well for you to see. Supreme Court punts. Decides not to take on a Louisiana voting map until next term, deciding today, once again just this morning, not to weigh in right now, at least, on Louisiana's contested congressional voting map. And what do they do? Instead, they decided, okay, we're going to punt this. We're going to send this into our next term, scheduling it for proceedings in the next term beginning in October. No explanation for why they did that. All but one paragraph in a six-page order was written by Judge Clarence Thomas, who's the lone dissent. He wrote that he thought the court has a duty today to hear that congressional redistricting challenge, and the justices have an obligation, he said, to resolve those challenges promptly. It's a twisted legal battle there about whether or not the decision to draw lines in Louisiana was prompted by racial considerations or political decisions based upon the 2020 census, something we've seen here in Wisconsin as well. And significantly, too, there is this case upholding, yes, indeed, another version, upholding a portion of the Affordable Care Act. Supreme Court on Friday upholding that portion of the Affordable Care Act that requires insurance companies to offer some kinds of preventive care for free. 6-3 decision. This one written by Brett Kavanaugh, the majority ruling that a federal task force, series of task forces that determine which preventive health measures insurance companies have to cover under the law, that requirement at no cost was indeed and is in fact constitutional. It plainly is good news for all of us, all of you who are in support of the Affordable Care Act. The case stemmed from a lawsuit brought by some parties seeking to block free preventive care. That preventive care also including things like cancer screening and medicine to prevent HIV transmission. Today, the Supreme Court is saying that no, those insurance companies are indeed obliged to follow what the task force says on preventive measures and provide that care absent any cost. All that and more coming out of the Supreme Court today. We're going to talk about all of that and more this weekend on Amicus Law Review. For today, on behalf of Jacob, on behalf of Jamie, on behalf of all of us here at Civic Media, on behalf of Maggie Dawn, I thank you for your time, your attention, and we look forward to more discussions like this on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Have a good Friday, everybody.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.